Side 9, The Mark of the Assassin by Daniel Silva. Continuing on page 431. The woman kicked the door. The latch broke and the door crashed open. Elizabeth's body went rigid. She felt as if she were made of stone. She forced herself to breathe slowly. Do it for Michael, she thought. Do it for the children inside you. She drew the arrow back hard on the string and pushed open the door with her foot. She saw Astrid Fogel, framed against the doorway, both hands on her gun, near her face. Astrid turned toward the sudden noise and leveled the gun with outstretched arms. Elizabeth released the arrow. The arrowhead struck Astrid in the base of her throat and drove her back, pinning her to the open door. Elizabeth screamed. Astrid's eyes opened wide and her lips parted. Somehow, she managed to hold on to the gun. She raised the weapon and started firing. The silencer dampened the explosions to a dull thud. Elizabeth threw herself back into the closet. The shots splintered the door, shattered the bedroom window, and tore plaster from the walls. She fell to the floor and curled herself into a ball. Then it stopped. The room was quiet, except for the wind and the clicking of Astrid Fogel attempting to fire an empty gun. Elizabeth got to her feet, took down another arrow, and stepped out of the closet. Astrid had ejected the spent cartridge and was digging in her coat pocket for another clip of ammunition. Blood pumped from the wound in her throat. She managed to pull the new clip from her pocket. Elizabeth said, "No, please don't. Don't make me do it again." Astrid looked at her, then at the arrow in her throat. The clip fell from her grasp, then the gun tumbled to the floor. She breathed deeply twice. Blood gurgled in her throat. Finally, her gaze went blank. Elizabeth fell to her knees and was violently sick. Michael, back downstairs in the basement, could hear October's footsteps above him, picking his way through the living room furniture. Michael knew October would be methodical and careful. He would search the house room by room until he found his target. To survive, Michael would have to outsmart October once again, the way he did on the footpath in Virginia. October was operating in alien territory. Michael could find his way through the house with his eyes closed. He would use that to his advantage. October had moved from the living room to the kitchen. He called out, "I have your wife, Mr. Osborne. If you come down now, unarmed, with your hands in the air, no harm will come to her. If you make me hunt you down like an animal, I'll kill her, too." Michael said nothing, just listened to October's progress through the first level of the house. After a moment, October said, "I remember that night in London, too, Mr. Osborne. I remember the sound of your screams along the river. She was a beautiful woman. You must have loved her very much. It was a pity she had to die. She was the first and only woman I ever killed. But I will not hesitate to kill your wife if you persist in this nonsense. Give yourself up, or she dies with you." Michael felt anger rising within him. Just hearing the man's voice after all these years filled him with horror. He tried to suppress it. He knew that was exactly the reaction October was trying to incite. If he lost his composure, if he acted with emotion instead of intelligence, he would die. He also knew October had no intention of allowing Elizabeth to live. "It must have hurt very badly to lose your lover like that, shot down like a dog right before your eyes," October said. "I heard they had to pull you from the field, send you back to headquarters. I heard it ruined you. Just think how you'll feel if I kill another one of your women. You won't want to live after that, I assure you. So just give yourself up, Mr. Osborne. Make it easy for both of us." Michael heard a scream from the guest cottage. Elizabeth screamed. "Sounds like things are getting interesting outside, Mr. Osborne. Pick up the telephone. Call the cottage. Tell your wife to give herself up. and she won't be harmed. You have my word on that. Michael walked across the room and pressed the talk button on the intercom. Very calmly, he said, "Your word means nothing to me, Nikolai Mikhailovich." "What did you call me?" October yelled back after a moment's hesitation. "I called you Nikolai Mikhailovich. It's your real name. Or did the wonderful people of the KGB keep that information from you? Nikolai Mikhailovich Vorontsov. Your father was General Mikhail Vorontsov, head of the first chief directorate of the KGB. You were his bastard child. Your mother was his mistress. As soon as you were old enough, your father gave you to the KGB to raise. Your mother ended up in the gulag. Would you like me to continue, Nikolai Mikhailovich?" Michael released the button and waited for October's reaction. He heard a door being kicked open, a ceramic lamp crashing to the floor, the dull thump of a silenced weapon being discharged. Michael was getting to him. "Your teacher was a man you knew only as Vladimir. You treated him like a father. For all intents and purposes, he was your father. When you were 16, you were infiltrated into the West through Czechoslovakia. You were ordered to kill your escorts. One of them was a woman, which makes you a liar as well as a murderer. You buried yourself in the West. 10 years later, when you were a man, you started killing. I could name most of your victims if you'd like, Nikolai Mikhailovich." Michael heard a window shatter and more rounds embedding themselves in the wall. He heard an empty cartridge fall to the floor and a fresh one rammed into place. Then he heard sirens a long way off and another scream from the cottage. He pressed the intercom again and said, "Who hired you?" More shots. "Who hired you, goddammit? Answer me." "I don't know who hired me." "You're lying. Your entire life is a lie." "Shut up. You're trapped here. You'll never get off this island alive. Neither will you. And neither will your wife. Astrid's been gone a long time. I wonder what's keeping her. Call the cottage. Tell your wife to give herself up." Michael set down his cellular telephone and picked up the receiver of the regular hardline phone. He heard October pick up an extension. The telephone rang once, and Elizabeth answered breathless. "Michael, my God, she's dead. I killed her. I shot her with an arrow. Michael, God, I don't want to be here with her. Oh, Michael, it's horrible. Please, I don't want to stay here with her." "Go to the dock. Take the dinghy out to the Alexandra. Wait there until the police arrive." "Michael, what are you?" "Just do what I say. Go to the Alexandra. Now." Elizabeth set down the telephone and walked to the window. She had known Michael more than 10 years. He had sailed on the boat countless times with her father. He knew it was called the Athena, not the Alexandra. It was possible he made a mistake because of the pressure of the situation, but she doubted it. It was intentional. It was for a reason. He wanted her to stay in the cottage, but he wanted October to think she was heading for the boat. She watched the main house through the window. She listened to the sirens draw nearer. She wanted to get out. She wanted a cigarette to mask the smell of Astrid Fogel's blood. She wanted this nightmare to be over. A few seconds later, she saw the screened door of the veranda swing open and the man called October running across the lawn toward the dock. Dolorosh plunged through the darkness. Wind ripped at the trees and nearly knocked him from his feet. The dock stretched before him into the darkness. 50 yards from shore, the sailboat swayed at its mooring, masts swinging like a pendulum in the white caps, halyards screaming in the wind. Michael Osborne's voice, distant and metallic, ran through his head like recorded announcements in a train station. "I called you Nikolai Mikhailovich. It's your real name." Dolorosh thought, God damn it, how could he know? The KGB had made him one promise. His existence in the West would be so secret Only a handful of people within the hierarchy would know the truth. So secret, he had been permitted to kill his escorts to the west that night in Austria. Had they lied? Had someone betrayed him? Was it Vladimir? Or Arbatov? Or the traitor Drozdov? Had Drozdov found the truth buried in the files at Moscow Center and sold it to his new masters in the west? Delaroche vowed to kill Drozdov if he ever got off Shelter Island alive. The revelation that the CIA had a dossier made Delaroche feel physically sick. Did they have a photograph, too? Usually, it was Delaroche who used the dossiers. Delaroche who leafed through the dark pages of a man's life until he found the weakness that would prove to be his undoing. Now Delaroche knew his enemies had assembled a dossier on his life, and Osborne had used it against him. "I called you Nikolai Mikhailovich." Reflexively, the killings ran through his mind. He tried to shut it off, but the faces appeared one by one, first vibrant and alive, then burst by three bullet wounds. Hassan Mahmoud, the Palestinian boy, Colin Yardley, and Eric Stoltenberg, Sarah Randolph. He could hear Michael Osborne's screams echoing along the Chelsea embankment. "It's your real name." Some nights Delaroche had a dream, and the dream played out in his imagination now. The men he had killed would confront him, armed with silenced automatics, and he would reach for his Glock pistol or his Beretta and find only paintbrushes. Then he would reach for his backup weapon and find only a pallet. "We know who you are," they would say, and begin to laugh. And Delaroche would raise his hands and shield his face, and the bullets would tear through his palms and bore through his eyes, and he would sit up in bed and tell himself it was only a dream, just a stupid fucking dream. Delaroche charged across the sloping lawn, feet flying over the wet springy turf, until the smack of his feet along the wooden dock shattered the nightmare image of his own death. He could hear the dinghy banging against the pylons of the dock, but the engine was silent. A few seconds later, he reached the end of the dock and looked down, gun leveled into the darkness. The dinghy was empty. "Drop the gun," Michael shouted over the wind. "Lie flat on the dock, face down, and do it very slowly." Michael stood at the foot of the dock, October at the end, 50 feet away. His left arm hung at his side. His right arm was bent at the elbow, and the gun was near his face. He was motionless. By the sound of the sirens, the police were on Shore Road now. They would arrive in a matter of seconds. "Drop the gun now," Michael yelled. "It's over. Just do what I say." October lowered his right arm until it hung straight at his side. The police reached the front gate. Michael heard the cottage door swing open. He turned in the direction of the sound and caught a glimpse of Elizabeth's beige sweater flashing through the darkness. He shouted, "Stay back, Elizabeth!" October dropped into a crouch and pivoted. The arm swung up. Michael fired several shots with the Browning, but they all sailed over October's head. The assassin fired three times through the darkness. One shot found its mark, tearing into the right side of Michael's chest. The Browning tumbled from his hand and clattered along the dock. Michael fell onto his back. His right arm went numb. Then he felt an intense, searing pain in his chest. The rain beat down on his face. Tree limbs twisted in the wind, and in his dementia, Michael thought they were giant hands clawing at his body. He drifted toward unconsciousness. He saw Sarah walking toward him on the Chelsea embankment, her long skirt dancing across buckskin boots. He saw her exploded face. He heard Elizabeth's voice calling from a long way off, incomprehensible. Finally, it cut through the fog of shock. "Michael, he's coming. Michael, please, God, Michael!" Michael lifted his head and saw October slowly advancing toward him. The Browning lay on the dock a few feet away. Michael tried to reach out with his right hand, but it would not obey his command to move. He rolled onto his right side and reached out with his left hand. He felt the cold metal of the Browning, the butt slick with rain. He grabbed hold of it, slipped his finger in the trigger guard, and fired down the dock. Delaroche saw the muzzle flash of Osborne's gun. He raised his Beretta as the first series of shots whizzed harmlessly past and took aim at Osborne's prone body. He took a step closer. He wanted to shoot him in the face. He wanted to avenge Astrid's death. He wanted to leave his mark. Osborne fired again. This time a bullet ripped through Delaroche's right hand, shattering bone. The Beretta tumbled from his grasp and fell into the swirling water below the dock. He looked down and saw fragmented bone jutting from the ugly exit wound on the back of his hand. He wanted to kill Osborne with his one good hand, break his neck or crush his windpipe. But Osborne still had his gun, and the police had entered the grounds. He turned, ran quickly down the dock, and leaped into the dinghy. He pulled the starter cord four times until the little outboard motor turned over. He untied the line and guided the boat away from the dock into Shelter Island Sound. Cannon Point was ablaze with flashing lights. Sirens filled the air. Above it all, Delaroche heard one thing: the screams of Elizabeth Osborne begging her husband not to die. Chapter 49, London. Is Osborne going to live? The director asked from the library of his home in St. John's Wood. His condition stabilized this evening, Mitchell Elliott said. There was some additional bleeding around midday, so the surgeons had to go back in. Unfortunately, it looks as though he's going to survive. Where is he? Officially, his location is secret. My source in Langley confirms Osborne is in the intensive care unit at Stony Brook Hospital on Long Island. I hope you realize Osborne is untouchable at this point, for the moment at least. Yes, I realize that, Director. He survived two attempts on his life. Under no circumstances is there to be a third. Of course, Director. He is a very worthy opponent, our Mr. Osborne. I have to say I admire him very much. I wish there were some way to entice him into working for me. He's a Boy Scout, Director, and Boy Scouts don't fit well into your organization. I suppose you're right. What's the status of October? Elliot asked. I'm afraid he received a rather rude welcome from the extraction team. And the advance payments we made to his Swiss bank account? All gone, I'm afraid. It seems October transferred the money from the account as quickly as it came in. That's a pity. Yes, but surely a man of your means isn't worried about a little loose change like that. Of course not, Director. There's still one target to be dealt with. I've already set those wheels in motion. Excellent. Do it skillfully, though. There's a great deal at stake. It will be done very skillfully. Mr. Elliot, I know I don't need to remind you that your first duty at this point is to protect the society at all costs. You must do nothing that would place the society in any harm whatsoever. I know I'll have your cooperation on that matter. Of course, Director. Very well. It's been a pleasure doing business with you. I only hope it wasn't all for naught. It's going to take all your considerable skills to ensure the survival of your missile defense contract. I'm confident that goal can be accomplished. Wonderful. Good night, Mr. Elliot. Good night, Director. The director replaced the receiver in its cradle. You're a very good liar, Daphne said. She let her silk gown fall from her shoulders and slipped into bed next to him. I'm afraid it's necessary in this line of work. She kissed him on the mouth and pressed her breasts against his body. Then she reached between his legs and took him in her hand. Anything, my love? She whispered. He kissed her and said, perhaps if you tried a little harder, Petal. Chapter 50, Washington, D.C. Paul Vandenberg parked on Ohio Drive, overlooking the Washington Channel, and shut down the engine. He had come alone in his private car, just as Elliot asked. The meeting was supposed to take place at 10 p.m., but Elliot was uncharacteristically late. Another car pulled in behind him, a large black four-wheel drive vehicle, its tinted windows pulsating to the beat of gangster rap music. Vandenberg started his engine and let it idle as he waited. The four-wheel drive left at 10:15. 5 minutes later, a black sedan pulled next to him, and the rear window descended. It was Mark Callahan, Mitchell Elliott's personal aide. "Mr. Elliott is terribly sorry, but there has to be a change of venue," Callahan said. "Come with me, and I'll bring you back to your car when the meeting is done." Vandenberg got out of his car and climbed into the back of the black sedan. They drove for 10 minutes, around Haynes Point, across the Memorial Bridge to Virginia, then north along the parkway. Callahan remained silent the entire time. It was one of Elliot's rules, no small talk between staff and clients. Finally, the car pulled into a parking lot overlooking Roosevelt Island. "Mr. Elliot is waiting for you on the island, sir," Callahan said politely. "I'll take you to him." The two men climbed out. The driver, Henry Rodriguez, waited behind the wheel. 2 minutes later, Rodriguez heard the snap of a single gunshot. A jogger found the body at 7:15 the following morning. It lay next to a marble bench at the memorial to Theodore Roosevelt, which the media deemed fitting, since Paul Vandenberg had always admired T.R. The gun had been placed in the mouth. A large section of the back of Vandenberg's head was gone. The slug was embedded in a tree trunk 60 feet away. The suicide note was found in the breast pocket of his woolen overcoat. It bore the hallmarks of all good Vandenberg memos. Concise, economical, to the point. He had taken his own life, the note said, because he was aware the Washington Post was preparing a devastating account of his fundraising activities over the years on behalf of James Beckwith. Vandenberg admitted guilt. Beckwith and Mitchell Elliott bore none of the responsibility. Vandenberg had planned and executed everything. He had taken his own life, the note said, because death by gunshot was preferable to death by independent counsel. A shaken James Beckwith appeared in the White House briefing room late in the afternoon, in time for the evening newscasts. He professed profound shock and sadness at the death of his closest aide. He then announced that the Justice Department would immediately commence a full and thorough investigation of all of Vandenberg's fundraising activities on Beckwith's behalf. He left the briefing room without taking questions and spent a quiet evening with Anne in the family quarters of the mansion. The following morning, the Post devoted much of page one to the apparent suicide of Paul Vandenberg. The coverage included a lengthy account of the financial relationship between James Beckwith and Mitchell Elliott. The piece disputed the claim, made in Vandenberg's suicide note, that he alone was the architect of the complex web of financial arrangements that had enriched the Beckwiths over the years. It also implicated Mitchell Elliott's Washington attorney, Samuel Braxton, Beckwith's nominee to be Secretary of State. The piece had a double byline: Tom Logan and Susanna Dayton, Washington Post staff writers. January. Chapter 51, Shelter Island, New York. Some nights were better than others. Some nights Elizabeth would see it all again in her dreams, and she would wake up screaming, trying to rub the imaginary bloodstains from her hands. Some nights Michael would awaken, having dreamed that October shot him 3 times in the face instead of once in the chest. The guest cottage was repaired and repainted, but Elizabeth never went there again. Sometimes Michael sat at the end of the dock and peered into the swirling waters. Sometimes an hour would pass before he would awaken from his trance. Sometimes Elizabeth would watch him from the lawn and wonder exactly what he was thinking. Of the aftermath, Michael knew only what he read in the newspapers or saw on television. But like any man born to the secret world, he generally regarded the news media as annoying background music. Each morning, the new caretaker would drive to the pharmacy in Shelter Island Heights and pick up the newspapers, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Newsday, and leave them on Michael's bedside table. By New Year's Day, Michael felt strong enough to make the journey, too. He would sit in the front passenger seat of his Jaguar and stare silently out the window at the water and the bare winter trees. His interest receded as January wore on, and by Inauguration Day, he had stopped reading the papers altogether. Beckwith successfully weathered the storm. Credit was given to his wife, Anne. Anne had become the president's most important advisor since the death of Paul Vandenberg. Newsweek put her on the cover of Christmas Week. Inside was a glowing article about her political acumen. Anne would have to play a critical role from the shadows if the second Beckwith term was to succeed. It was Anne, according to Washington's chattering class, who goaded the president into pressing for sweeping campaign finance reform. With the fervency of the newly converted, Beckwith called for a ban on unregulated contributions to the parties, the soft money, and pressed broadcasters to give candidates free airtime. By Inauguration Day, his approval ratings had reached 60%. Two of Beckwith's closest friends and supporters did not fare as well. Samuel Braxton was forced to withdraw his nomination to be Secretary of State. He denied all wrongdoing, but said he did not want to tie American foreign policy in knots by engaging in a long and divisive confirmation fight. It was Anne, according to the media, who pushed Braxton off the cliff. Alitron Defense Systems voluntarily withdrew from the National Missile Defense Project after Andrew Sterling, Beckwith's defeated rival and chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, promised to conduct the congressional equivalent of a rectal exam on Mitchell Elliott. The contract was awarded to another California defense contractor, and Sterling gave his reluctant support, ensuring the system would be funded and deployed. 2 days before the inauguration, the FBI and U.S. Park Police released the findings of their investigation into the death of White House Chief of Staff Paul Vandenberg. Investigators found no evidence to suggest his death was anything but a suicide. The investigation into the murders of Max Lewis and Virginia State Trooper Dale Preston produced no arrests. The Washington Metropolitan Police Department quietly ended its investigation into the murder of Susanna Dayton. The case file remained technically open. Elizabeth spent long weekends on the island. She worked 3 days a week from the New York office of Braxton, Allworth, and Cattleman, while she gradually shed her caseload and auditioned new firms. Because of her record and her political connections, she had no shortage of suitors. The venerable New York firm Titan, Webster, and Leach offered the most money and, more important, the most flexibility. She accepted their offer and faxed Samuel Braxton her letter of resignation that same afternoon. Michael healed faster than his doctors expected. Snow fell the first week of January, and the weather turned bitterly cold. But the following week, the air warmed, and his doctors ordered him out of the house for gentle walks. The first 2 days, he gingerly strolled the grounds of Cannon Point, his right arm in a sling because October's bullet had shattered his collarbone and cracked his shoulder blade. On the third day, he walked in the wind on Shore Road, a pair of Adrian Carter's security men trailing softly behind him. In a week's time, he walked to the village and back in the morning, and in the late afternoon, he would walk the long, rocky beaches of Ram Island. In the evenings, he wrote in Douglas Cannon's library overlooking Daring Harbor. After 3 days, he showed the first draft to his father-in-law. Cannon edited with a red pencil, sharpening Michael's stiff bureaucratic prose, honing the logic of the arguments and conclusions. When it was finished, he overnighted it to Adrian Carter at Langley. "There's nothing I hate more than Washington on Inauguration Day," Carter said the following evening. "I could use some sea air and some of Cannon's wine. Mind if I come up for a couple of days?" "How much longer do I have to put up with these goons?" Michael asked the next afternoon as he bumped along the sixth fairway of the Gardner's Bay Country Club in a golf cart. A pair of CIA security officers in matching Patagonia parkas rode in a cart behind them, muttering into handheld radios. "Shit, I trickled into the rough," Carter said, as he lurched to a stop next to his ball and climbed out of the cart. He pulled a 9-iron from his bag and prepared for a 140-yard shot to the green. "Are you going to answer my question?" Michael said. "Jesus, Michael, come on. Not while I'm addressing the ball." Carter struck the shot. The ball plopped into the left bunker. "God damn it, Osborne." "Go easy on yourself, Tiger. It's 38 degrees out here." Carter climbed into the cart and drove toward the green. "Those goons, as you put it, are here to protect you and your family, Michael. And they'll stay until I'm satisfied your life is no longer in any danger." "Right now my life is in danger because I'm riding in an open golf cart in the middle of winter." "I'll take you home after 9 and play the back alone." "You're insane. You should take up the game." "I have enough frustration in my life. Self-inflicted wounds I can live without. Besides, I'll be lucky if I can ever raise a beer with this arm, let alone swing a golf club." "How's Elizabeth doing?" "As well as can be expected, Adrian. Killing takes its toll, even when it's in self-defense. The fact that you were able to keep it from going public has made it easier for her. I can't thank you enough." "She's a gem," Carter said. "I've always said you're the luckiest man I know." Carter's chip rolled past the cup, leaving him with a 10-foot putt for bogey. "Fuck it," he said. "It's too goddamn cold for golf. Let's spend the afternoon by the fire getting drunk." "Did you read it?" Michael asked, as Carter pulled the cork from an Italian Merlot and poured 2 glasses. "Yes, I read it. I had one of 2 choices. Shit can it or pass it up the line." "Which choice did you make?" "I chose the coward's route. Passed it up the line with no comment." "You're a chicken shit." "It's called a bureaucratic shuffle, protecting one's flank."
"Protecting one's ass?"
"Same thing. You could learn a thing or two from me. Your ass is usually fully exposed, hanging in the wind." "I'm a field man, Adrian. Field men make lousy desk men. You always said so yourself."
"That's true."
"So how come you became such a great desk man?"
"Because I wanted a life. And I couldn't have a life if I was running from one shithole to the next, trying to remember what my cover name was that week."
"Who'd you give my memo to?"
"Monica Tyler, of course."
"Let me guess. She shit-canned it. In a New York minute."
"I didn't expect her to do anything else."
"So why did you write it?"
"Because I believe it to be true."
"You seriously believe Mitchell Elliott, with the assistance of the secret band of rogue operatives, brought down that airliner so he could build his missile defense system?"
Michael nodded.
"Yes, I do." "That falls into the category of a charge too dangerous to make, not without conclusive proof. Monica recognized that, and so did I. Frankly, what bothers me is why an officer of your experience can't see it." Elizabeth knocked and entered the room. The senator had convinced her to take the Athena out on the bay with him for a couple of hours. Her face was bright red with the cold. She stood before the fire and warmed her backside against the flames. Carter said, "I thought you were supposed to be taking it easy."
"Dad did all the sailing," she said.
"I just drank herbal tea and tried to keep from freezing to death."
"Everything all right?"
Carter asked. "Everything's fine. The babies are perfect."
"God, that's wonderful," he said, and a large smile broke across his usually placid face.
"What were you boys talking about?"
"Shop," Carter said.
"Okay, I'm leaving."
"Stay,"
Michael said. "Michael, some of this is..." "She can hear it firsthand, or she can hear it later in bed. Take your pick, Adrian."
"Stay," he said.
"Besides, it's nice to have something beautiful to look at. Make yourself useful, Michael, and pour me some more wine." "Elizabeth?" She shook her head. "I'm off booze and cigarettes for a while." Carter drank some wine and said,
We received a report from the French service 2 days ago. They believe they've discovered the cover identity of October. He was living along the Breton coast under the name Jean-Paul Delaroche, a village called Brelay.
Jesus, we've been there, Michael.
He lived quietly in a cottage overlooking the channel. It seems he was also a talented painter. The French are keeping it quiet, as only the French can do. We have a worldwide alert for him, but so far we've had no sightings. We've also heard from a number of different sources that he's actually dead.
Dead? How?
Apparently, whoever hired him to kill you wasn't pleased that he failed to fulfill the contract.
I hope they tortured him first,
Elizabeth said. Michael was looking out the window toward the dock and the white-capped bay beyond. Elizabeth said,
What are you thinking about, Michael?
I'd just like to see a body, that's all.
We all would, Carter said. But these things usually don't work like that.
He finished the wine and held out his glass for more. Elizabeth opened another bottle. The senator came into the room, face red, hair windblown.
I see you've raided the cellar, he said. Pour me a vast amount, please.
Carter said, I have one other piece of serious business before we get too drunk.
If you must, Michael said. Monica has agreed to drop all disciplinary proceedings against you. She thinks they are inappropriate at this point, given what you and Elizabeth have endured.
Oh, isn't that nice of Monica? Come on, Michael. She's serious. She thinks the whole thing got out of hand. She wants to put it behind us and move on.
Michael looked at Elizabeth, then back at Carter. Tell her thanks, but no thanks, he said.
You want the disciplinary proceedings to go forward?
No, I want out, Michael said. I've decided to leave the agency.
You're not serious.
Dead serious, Michael said. Sorry, poor choice of words. Okay, now we can get drunk. Elizabeth crossed the room, leaned down, and kissed Michael's lips.
Are you sure, Michael? Don't do it for me.
I've never been so sure about anything in my entire life. And I'm not doing it for you. I'm doing it for us. Then he touched her stomach. And for them. She kissed him again and said, Thank you, Michael. I love you. I hope you know that.
I know, he said. God, I know.
Carter looked at his watch and said, Oh, shit.
What?
Michael and Elizabeth said in unison. We missed Beckwith's address. And they all burst out laughing. Epilogue. Mykonos, Greece. It was the villa no one wanted. It clung to a cliff top overlooking the sea, exposed to the eternal wind. Stavros, the real estate agent, had given up on the idea of selling the property. He simply rented it each year to the same clan of young British stockbrokers who pillaged the island each August for 3 drunken weeks. The Frenchman with the injured hand spent just 5 minutes in the house. He toured the bedrooms and the living room and inspected the views from the stone terrace. He paid particular attention to the kitchen, which made him frown.
I know men who can do the work for you, if you wish to undertake renovations, Stavros said.
That won't be necessary, the Frenchman said. I'll do the work myself.
But your hand, Stavros said, nodding at the bandage.
It's nothing, the Frenchman said. A kitchen accident. It will heal soon. Stavros frowned, as though he found the story unconvincing.
It's a popular rental, he continued. If you wish to leave the island at the high season, I'm certain I can fetch a good price for it, especially if you make repairs.
The villa is no longer for rent.
Very well. When would you like to...
Tomorrow, the Frenchman said. Give me an account number, and I'll have the money wired this afternoon.
But, monsieur, you are not Greek. It's not easy for a foreigner to buy property. There are forms to fill out, legal documents. These things take time.
See to it, Mr. Stavros. But I'm moving in here tomorrow morning. He spent the remainder of winter inside. When his hand had healed sufficiently, he went to work, mending the villa with the devotion of a monk copying the ancient books. Christos, the man from the home supply store, offered to find good men to help with the work, but the Frenchman politely refused. He replaced the kitchen appliances and laid a new ceramic countertop. He repainted the entire interior. He carted away the old furniture, ghastly modern pieces, and filled the rooms with rustic Grecian chairs and tables. In March, when the weather warmed, he turned his attention to the exterior. He patched cracks in the walls and put down a coat of gleaming whitewash. He replaced the broken tiles on the roof and the broken stones on the terrace. By the middle of April, the villa no one wanted was the finest in the village. The Italian racing bicycle arrived that same week. Each morning he rode along the winding coast roads and up and down the steep hills in the center of the island. Gradually, as the days lengthened, he spent more and more time in the village. He dawdled over the olives and rice and lamb in the marketplace. A few afternoons each week, he took his lunch in the taverna, always with a book for protection. Sometimes he bought broiled sea bass from the boys on the beach and ate the fish alone in a grotto where gray seals played. He ventured into the wine shop. At first he drank only French and Italian wines, but after a time he developed a taste for inexpensive Greek varieties. When the clerk suggested more costly vintages, the Frenchman would shake his head and hand the bottle back. The renovations, he explained, had put a dent in his finances. At first his Greek was limited, a few staccato sentences, a vague, untraceable accent. But remarkably, within 2 months, he could conduct his business in passable Greek with the accent of an islander. The village women made gentle advances, but he took no lovers. He had only one pair of visitors, a small Englishman with eyes the color of winter seawater, and a mulatto goddess who sunbathed nude in the May sunshine. The Briton and the goddess stayed for 3 days. Each evening they dined on the terrace late into the night. In May he began to paint. At first he could hold his brushes for only a few minutes at a time because of the scar tissue in his right hand. Then, slowly, gradually, the scar tissue stretched and gave way, and he was able to work for several hours at a time. For many weeks he painted the scenes around the villa, the seascapes, the clusters of whitewashed cottages, the flowers on the hillsides, the old men taking wine and olives at the taverna. The villa reflected the changing colors of each passing day, a dusty pink at dawn, a filtered raw sienna at dusk that took weeks of patient experimentation to recreate on his palette. In August, he began painting the woman. She was blonde, with striking blue eyes and pale, luminous skin. According to his cleaning lady, he worked without a model from a handful of crude pencil sketches. Clearly, she told the other girls in the village, the Frenchman is working from memory. It was a large work, about 6 feet by 4 feet. The woman wore only a white blouse, unbuttoned to her navel, tinged with the raw sienna of the setting sun. Her long body was draped over a small wooden chair, facing backward. One hand rested beneath her chin. The other held something that looked like a gun, though no one would put a gun in the hand of a woman so beautiful, the maid said. Not even the recluse Frenchman. He finished the work in October. He placed it in a simple frame and hung it on the wall facing the sea. Acknowledgements. The events portrayed in this novel are entirely the product of the author's imagination, as are the characters that populate it. Still, several men and women similar to the people in this story gave me invaluable assistance, without which this work would not have been possible. The expertise is all theirs. The mistakes, simplifications, and dramatic license are all mine. Several current and former members of the American intelligence community allowed me to peek behind the curtain into their world, and I wish to express my gratitude to them, especially the professionals at the CIA's Counterterrorism Center in Langley, Virginia, who patiently answered as many of my questions as they could and generously shared a few pieces of their lives along the way. So much has been written about working in the White House, but several people from various administrations helped me fill in the blanks with their personal memories. Some of their insight helped shape this work, and some of it was just tucked away. But I'm indebted to all of them. In my previous life, I was privileged to work with Brooks Jackson, who covers the intersection of money and politics for CNN, and is one of the finest reporters in Washington. His wisdom was invaluable, though nothing written on the pages of a novel could ever do justice to the spirit and expertise of his work. James Hackett and John Pike helped me decipher the Rubik's Cube of national ballistic missile defense, and also argued passionately for and against it. Obviously, I am to blame for the frightening oversimplification of missile defense contained in this book, not them. I also wish to express my profound thanks to Dr. Zev Rosenwax and Wally Padillo of the Center for Reproductive Medicine and Infertility at New York Hospital Cornell Medical Center. Also to Chris Plant, who helped me better understand Stinger missiles. Over the years, three dear friends, Tom Kelly, Martha Rogers, and Greg Craig, have given me a window on the world of Washington law, even though they never realized I was gathering material for a book. I thank them for their insight and, more importantly, their friendship. As always, Ian Trewin, the managing director of Weidenfeld & Nicholson in London, gave me priceless counsel, as did his assistant, Rachel Lation. A very special thanks to the team at International Creative Management, Heather Schroeder, Alicia Gordon, Tricia Davey, Jack Horner, Sloan Harris, and, of course, Esther Newberg. And finally, to the talented and dedicated staff at Random House, Adam Rothberg, Jake Krisovich, Sybil Pincus, Leona Nevler, and Linda Gray, and especially my editors, Brian DeFiore and Anne Goodoff. There are none better. End of The Mark of the Assassin by Daniel Silva. Read by Ted Stoddard in the studios of Potomac Talking Book Services, Incorporated, for the Library of Congress, August 1998. Published by Villard Books, a division of Random House, Incorporated, New York, New York, 10022. Further reproduction or distribution in other than a specialized format is prohibited. If you found any cassette in this book to be defective, please place a rubber band or piece of string around that cassette for identification. Place it in the container on top of the front stack of cassettes.